Cuarto esfuerzo, Ben O'Connor. Gracias, ahí está. Luchando por mantener la segunda plaza.
Yeah, I wasn't really surprised, but I didn't expect myself to be so bad at the end, so a bit average to be honest, but yeah, I guess that's just the reality.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2024 Vuelta a España from Lisboa to Madrid.
Buenas tardes, Rob Hatch.
Buenas tardes, ¿qué tal?
Kern Farmers, Rob Hatch, dressed in racing green today, but
we saw a great
race up here on the Alto de Moncavillo, but it wasn't a Kern Farmer victory today. Rob, describe the scene, describe where we are. Who are we waiting for?
We're like cattle. We're in a pen. We're waiting for the new red jersey. We're waiting for Primoz Roglic, aren't we?
The new red jersey, because as you heard at the top of the show, well, it finally happened, didn't it? The judgment day finally came for Ben O'Connor. Primoz Roglic landed the coup de grace. We were debating earlier, we're still in Rioja today, we were debating whether it was a Roble, a Crianza, a Reserva, or a Gran Reserva. I think we settled somewhere in between a Reserva and Gran Reserva, a vintage Roglification. And yes, that's who we are waiting on, because he did win the stage convincingly, emphatically. We will tell you in due course by exactly how much and where that leaves us ahead of tomorrow's stage. Tomorrow's Mountain Showdown, Queen Stage, 4,780-something metres
how
of
many?
Climbing to Picon Blanco. But old Rog is probably going to round that corner any moment. Just as he rounded the corner at the top of the Alto de Moncalvillo about 20 minutes ago, Rob, as we always do, we should go back to this morning, go back in time to this morning. Where were we this morning?
We were in Logroño, the capital of La Rioja, the smallest or the least populated of the Spanish mainland regions.
And yesterday we talked at length about and to Salt Bay. Well, there was some beef to deal with this morning, wasn't there? There was some beef to clean up this morning, because, well, we did touch on it yesterday, the T-Rex debacle, Mattia Cattaneo. We didn't realise, I don't think, to what extent he was miffed. I'm not sure we'd seen the pictures of him sort of gesticulating. I must say, in a very reserved fashion, in a very sort of understated fashion, he's that kind of character. With the team car, when they told him, I think it was 12 kilometres from the finish, to wait for his old mate, Mikel Landa, he did that, therefore sacrificing a stage victory. So that's all needed to be digested, cleaned up, explained this morning. We endeavoured to do that, didn't we, Rob?
We did, and you went to sprinkle some salt on it, didn't you? Just like Salt Bay.
And who gave us the Sudal Quickstep party line this morning? A very sort of downtrodden looking, I must say, or slightly chastised looking Ilio Queso, wasn't it?
Yeah, I felt for him actually. He looked like he was sort of trembling a little bit. He'd obviously had a difficult night. He told us actually, didn't he, as you'll hear in a minute, that he was up half the night watching the images back. So he wasn't feeling great. The team weren't feeling great. But of course, you spoke to him and he fronted up.
So Ilio, yesterday was a complicated one, I think, for a lot of teams. Two big groups, and then radio communication might have been an issue, but the main question that people have is why Cattaneo wasn't sent back earlier for Mikel. Just tell us what happened in the car.
I think the most important, yesterday in the car there was, like you said, no communication. There was no telephone signal. The two cars were too far separated from each other. So we can go quite far, but 10 minutes is just too far. So no communication between the two cars. No communication with the riders that were in front from our car. I mean, so we had Kata in front, we had Mori and Pedersen a little bit more back, and then we had Mikel alone in a bad situation. We also did not expect that situation at that moment. You always expect something, but not from Mikel to drop from that whole group. Maybe he could have dropped from Carapaz, from Roglic, from Mas, like happened the previous days, weeks. But we did not expect him to drop from O'Connor, Rodriguez, Sivakov, and so on. So then I think in the red jersey group, the group Carapaz, everything came together. Their plan worked really well. We were a bit surprised, and with the lack of communication, we got in a very, very difficult situation. It took too long for Van Zevenant and Pedersen to get to the group of Mikkel to help him. Like this, he lost too much time. And then, honestly, really late, also still 10 minutes up the road, there was communication with Kata. We asked what his feeling was, if he could win the stage. He said he was not 100% sure, that there were some riders that made a very good impression to him. Also three teammates of Ken Pharma and so on. So then we decided also to let Kata wait, to try to save the day a little bit. But in the end, it was just a very, very bad day for us.
And just going back to where Mikkel had his problems, was part of that positioning, or was it all legs?
It was not about positioning. I think if you see, I rewatched the race over and over again. I did not sleep too much last night. We were always, was Ajay Desert was pulling in the main group. We had Movistar there, Bora there, EF was there, we were there like every other day. Also towards the climb, you could see there was a lot of talking with Movistar, with EF. So of course that it worked out that well for them. And then, like I said, they had their guys on top of the climb. They started working together. Also French guy, Pache was in between. Kind of Blanco was in between. They all started riding. Skelmose started pulling. Yeah, it was just all against one. And then it went really fast.
We saw Mattia at the moment when he was speaking to the car. I guess he wasn't thrilled. But what have you sort of cleared everything up either tonight or this morning? And is everyone kind of okay now with the situation that played out and what they have to do today?
I must say Mattia has been incredible the last 3 weeks how he's been riding. He's super professional. He stayed always with Mika. And yesterday we wanted to give him a chance to go for the stage also. In the end we pulled him back. Sure, he was not happy with that. Nobody. Also not me, not nobody was happy with that decision. But it was one we had to take probably that moment. It was really late, and especially with him 10 minutes in front, but he really did a full stop like we asked to do. And yeah, he always said, and also yesterday before the stage we said, yeah, maybe if a really big group goes and they go for the stage, you have your chance, you can slide in, but if there is a situation with Mikkel, we might have to pull you back. He knew that. So no, he accept that. He's super professional, but of course it was not nice for him, not nice for the team also. Looked really clumsy.
Well, Rob, tail between the legs for a lot of the Soudal Quick-Step, well, the Direct Sportif, the star, not the T-Rex. We saw the T-Rex's tail flapping around this morning. You took a picture, didn't you? Well, I took a picture of you with the T-Rex.
Someone else took a picture of one, well, a video, didn't they? The sponsors were very happy that Primoz Roglic was in carnivorous mood this morning with the T-Rex.
Very good. I think people are switching off at this point. Victor Campenaerts also gave the T-Rex a peck on the cheek before the start. Did you see that? I think that's on our Instagram as well. But this morning, Rob, well, we knew that today was going to be a key one for this Vuelta a España. It was a stage that I think even when we did our preview weeks ago, we said would suit Primoz Roglic perfectly, not only because he had won here in 2020, but it wasn't quite a hockey stick stage, an Unipuerto stage, but he certainly, well, we've heard many times in this Vuelta a España, he favours these stages with a sort of 20 to 30 minute climb at the end. And, well, should we find out? Already spoiled the stage to a certain extent, but should we find out how it all panned out with the resumen de la etapa?
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
Rob, we've moved to the forest. We're in my natural, we're on my natural terrain now, headed in deep into the forest. We've finished our duties in the mix zone, and it is time for the tale of the etapa, stage 19, Logroño to the Alto de Moncalvillo. I've got a whole list of really awful puns, wine-related puns that Rob has spent all day working on in expectation of what we duly saw with Primož Roglič. Maybe we can save those. Maybe we'll be able to unsheath one of those
in a while. We'll put them in the cellar, never to be recovered again.
Yeah.
Tell you what, the one who's doing the tale of the etapa, the other should be looking around here for bears and stuff, because it's a beautiful scene. The light's amazing today, isn't it, after the last few days of racing? We're at the top of the Moncalvillo. I'm looking around the trees, but yeah, there's
beautiful birds of prey.
Yeah, well, maybe that's it. We should be looking up as well as around. You got me scared here. Let's get on with it, shall we?
Rob, off you go. Or I'll tell you what, I'll tell the listeners there were 2,746 metres of climbing today, spread over two main ascents, both classified the Puerto de Pradilla, which was 5.3 kilometres at 5%, and then we had the final climb. That was around halfway into the stage, wasn't it, Rob?
Yeah, the first climb was halfway around. First climb was halfway into the stage. Second climb, the Alto del Moncalvillo, obviously the finishing climb. It was rising for a good 15 kilometres, wasn't it? But 8.6 kilometres, 8.9%, getting harder and harder until the final last 500 metres. Maximum gradient, 16%. We drove it, or rather you drove it, having to take great care of the many people that were all over the road. It was narrow, there were hairpins. It was a nasty one, wasn't it?
It was, harder than I remembered, actually, Rob. Very irregular as well. And it was one of those climbs where if you looked at the road book, it looked a fairly sort of smooth, regular 9%, 10%. But in fact, within that, within each kilometre, there were ramps of sort of 12, 15, and then back down to 5 and 6 again.
Yep, and well, second time we've been here at the Vuelta. Roglic won in 2020, wearing the green jersey then over a Carapaz in red.
Like you today.
Roglic, just a bit like me, my emergency purchase that I didn't need in the end because it's sunny. But Roglic on that day, beating Carapaz, who was in the lead, and kept it. And there had been a stage of the Vuelta a la Rioja here in 1994, 30 years ago, the late El Chava Jimenez winning. At the start today then, general classification gaps, 5 seconds between O'Connor in red and Roglic in second. A minute 25 back to Enric Mas. And of course, the other big story in the top 10 had been Landa dropping from 5th to 10th. Landa started the day at 5:38 from the Australians' lead. No non-starters, thankfully. So 139 riders began in Logroño. 5 kilometres later than planned, though. A few roadworks, mechanical issues. When we got going, it was a fairly formulaic day, wasn't it, in the end? 5 riders away, Isaac del Toro, Edward Plankert, Fran Mihaljevic, Vito Brat and Simone Petilli, the latter two of the same team, Antomarche, in the break. Sepulveda was a late chaser, but he didn't make it. The break was set at 5 riders, gap at 5 minutes, 110 kilometres of the 180 to go. And then we had a crash for Jay Vine today.
Did you see that crash?
I didn't.
Rob?
The commentators on Spanish television didn't see it either, and we heard about it thanks to their motorbike reporter who was in there. Apparently crashed on his own. We saw him being bandaged up by the doctors on both sides. Vine, of course, no longer in the King of the Mountains jersey. Lost that to his teammate yesterday, Marc Soler. In the peloton, Red Bull were controlling, and it was set up for that day. And that word you like to use, that Roglification. Gap down to 4 minutes fairly quickly, 100 kilometres remaining, and it just continued to come down all day. We got to the final climb of the day. They were brought up, swallowed up just as the final climb started. Mihaljevic was the last survivor of Bahrain victorious. Red Bull then took control for the first couple of kilometres. What did we see? We saw Aleotti, Adria, and then the fun started, didn't it? 5.8 to go. Dani Martinez had done the turn of all turns, and it was him that really lit
short,
up the race.
Short but hard.
Was it that short? It was maybe
a couple of hundred metres, 300-400 metres.
I'd been riding a little bit before then. He was really strong today, was Martinez. I would say, of course, apart from the winner, I'd say he's probably man of the match today for that turn. Because he didn't just launch Roglic. What he did, Daniel, was pretty spectacular, wasn't it? Because he launched 3 team members, and it was like a quick team time trial off the front.
somewhat frustratingly, we've just had Primoz Roglic in the mix zone, and we're going to hear that interview in a minute. We didn't get to ask him, but I would have quite liked to ask him whether that was a choreographed move, because he did say that he was sort of reluctant to go for the stage win today. His team kind of twisted his arm, but it looked very much to me like a choreographed move. It reminded me, in fact, of the Giro d'Italia stage to Turin, or to and from Turin. When was that? When Simon Yates won the stage and Bora did a big sort of collective kind of onslaught, and Vlasov can't have been involved that day, was he? It was a couple of years
ago.
Was he
in the team at that day?
No, he wasn't.
Astana, probably, I think, at that time. You mentioned Vlasov. I spoke to him as well briefly afterwards as well, and he gave me a very short version, as he often does, but he was kind enough to say a couple of words. He gave me a very short version, sort of backing up what Primoz Roglic said there, that the initial plan wasn't to go for the stage, but then, you know, they felt all right, blah, 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 blah. It went. And when it went, it was spectacular. Vlasov then worked for Roglic for a little while, and Roglic was soon away on his own. 5Ks to go when Roglic already was on his own. 4.9 to be exact.
I turned to his agent at that point, who, incidentally, you mentioned Mihail Jevic, who was the last survivor of the break. He's also his agent as well. I turned to his agent and said, it's too early. I was expecting Roglic to suffer a Roglic side at that point. However, not the case.
He thought Salt Bae was going to be the assassin, rubbing more salt into the wounds, didn't
he? Well, Salt Bae was the first mover, wasn't he, behind that Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe sort of train. Roglic quickly, well, those three quickly opened a gap of sort of 10, 15, 20 seconds. It went to very quickly, didn't it? And the first rider who tried in vain to bridge across was Salt Bae, David Gaudu. But he did look a bit medium rare at that point.
He certainly did, dearing me. If you're still with us,
please just take us off air.
We continued to go up the climb. There were attacks from Mas, from Carapaz, and the group started us. The only thing that wasn't really changing on the climb was Roglic. He was out. It was that, you know, Roglification finish, and he had what, at 1.25. It did come down to 20 seconds when Mas was on the way, but then Mas faded, didn't he? And Roglic just continued doing what he was doing, and in the end, he just continued to add and add to his advantage. Then O'Connor was dropped from that group, the chasing group, and it was clear that we were going to have a new leader anyway, because there's no chance of him getting onto the next group, even if Roglic did fade towards the end. So O'Connor was losing the red jersey, and behind they were fighting each other. Moves including Skilmores are making his way up as well, which is important for the white jersey. He got in front of Sugarman Carlos Rodriguez towards the finish, and in the end,
Sugarman, I met a friend of the podcast earlier, Tom, who lives in, where does he live? Oliva, somewhere over there in the Costa Blanca, an American good friend of the podcast, good friend of Stacey Snyder, who does our mugs for the Grand Tours every year. And he's been following the Vuelta a España for a few days now with a group of friends, a group of Americans, and they've been shouting Sugarman at Carlos Rodriguez when he's emerged from the bus every day. But I'm told that thus far he hasn't bitten, or he's shown no signs of embracing that nickname.
I think we need to get the greatest hits out tomorrow and play it outside the bus, see if he reacts. But then again, there wasn't too much else to tell, was there? Final results, I think we'll give you them now when we get them up here on the mountain internet we've got. The stage results were Primoz Roglic winning by 46 seconds from David Gaudu and Matthias Skelmoser,
which we decided, I think, puts it in the category of a reserva, maybe
Gran reserva. I mean, he won by 13 seconds last time. That, of course, maybe was a bit early in his career, and, you know, we're used to it now, aren't we? So we've more sort of what bottles in the cellar to compare it to.
Well, maybe it should be a gran reserva because, of course, what distinguishes Roble, which is the lowest category, and Crianza, reserva, gran reserva, is the amount of time they're aged. So 4 years on from Primoz Roglic's first victory up here on the Alto de Montcalvillo,
and a 15th Vuelta a España stage win for Primoz Roglic in his career. 5 years consecutively coming here, winning stage. Of course, he's won three Vueltas, and now with that result, you would say that he's on his way to winning a fourth, because the new general classification is Primoz Roglic with, suddenly looking, it's funny, the first time I've looked down at Daniel, and it looks a rather big lead. 1 minute 54 on Ben O'Connor, who remains on the podium in second place. Enric Mas will be eyeing at least that second place tomorrow if he can try and put pressure on. He's in third at 2:20. Carapaz is fourth at 2:54. Salt Bae Gaudu at 4:33, I should say, in fifth. And Skelmoser, will mention him because he moves up from seventh to sixth. He is at 4:47, but crucially now has 8 seconds on Sugarman Rodriguez in the white jersey. classification.
But didn't sound terribly confident in maintaining that advantage tomorrow, did he, in the mix zone? We'll maybe discuss that in a short while.
No, that's often the sort of vibe he gives off, though.
What did I say yesterday in the car? Schelmer, he has the tone of voice of someone who's just sort of spent several hours repairing flood damage in his basement. He always sort of sounds, and this is just the Danish kind of intonation generally, isn't it? There is a sort of a kind of labouredness at times, regardless of his movie. He's a very cheerful fellow, actually. He's good with the media and gives very good interviews.
Yeah, I think I'm a cheerful fellow, but I think I'd be speaking rather laboured if I'd been racing up the Alto del Moncalvillo.
Well, talking of which, Rob, you've just given us the general classification. Well, let's recap first the other classifications before we move on. Talk about a rider who was very laboured in the closing sort of couple of kilometres of today's climb. The other classification, Marc Soler leads by 1 point over his teammate, Jay Vine, who was a little bit beaten up after that crash. I wonder how they divvy that one up tomorrow, or whether they decide to divvy it up, whether they decide to race against each other. Of course, Jay Vine was instrumental in Marc Soler's stage win on the Lagos de Covadonga. We heard them, didn't we, embracing at the finish line, and Jay Vine's very heartfelt tribute to his teammates and mate. But will they duke it out tomorrow for the Mountains Prize? A lot of points available tomorrow.
A lot of points available. There's three riders in the top nine from that team, because Adam Yates is down in ninth place as well. What we can imagine, certainly given the way the general classification's gone as well, it'll be like an en masse attack from that team tomorrow. They will be hunting for the stage. And if anybody wants to do something in the general classification tomorrow, pick up the phone, call Machin and say, we'll ride with you tomorrow. You can have the stage, we'll move up. Because they are the team I think everyone will be looking at to attack and try and win.
Could be El Siv, Pavel Sivakov, who won on a stage that it didn't finish atop the Picon Blanco, but it certainly went over the Picon Blanco in the Vuelta a Burgos a couple of years ago. We're going to hear from him later in the podcast about that. In fact, Rob, did you give the time gaps on the white jersey classification?
8 seconds.
You did? Well, without further ado then, let's hear from the two main protagonists of today's stage. Ben O'Connor, finally dethroned after 12 days in the Mayo Rojo. I'm going to hear from him first. And as I already said, he was pretty disappointed and overly self-critical when he crossed the line. And then we're going to hear from a very magnanimous, certainly, as regards Ben O'Connor and his stint in red, Primoz Roglic.
Oh, I was a bit broken at the end there. I actually felt pretty good until about halfway. And then, yeah, just stage 19, I guess.
Could you expect that attack from three riders from Red Bull Bora?
Yeah, I wasn't really surprised, but I didn't expect myself to be so bad at the end, so a bit average to be honest, but yeah, I guess that's just the reality.
After 13 days in the red jersey, what's in your mind right now?
Oh. Monday and having beers and sitting on the terrace and relaxing.
Tomorrow we can expect a big fight to keep that position, second position in the podium.
Yeah, I mean, tried today, but I didn't really do my best work. So it comes down tomorrow. Then obviously we have Sunday as well. So still two very important days. No, I actually feel really good. Just kind of just came out of the blue. I like being a leader. I like the responsibility, but I also hate when you lose it. So just got to get to the end of this race first, and now think about that later.
Congratulations, Primoz. Do you know which number of stage victories this one in La Vuelta?
Thank you.
I'm going to help you. 15. That's quite something. How does it feel?
Good. I mean, you never know. Like I always say, when is the last one? Always beautiful to win.
Primoz, this morning speaking with the DSs, the plan didn't look like it at the end happened, but tell us how it's been in this climb. How did you face it?
I didn't really want to go for the stage, but some guys said anyway. I mean, we will go and pull if you want it or not, then okay. I mean, we had to go on the same page, so I said okay. Anyway, no one wanted to ride and would take super long to come to the finish, so I said yeah. I mean, then we ride now. Because also then the transfer is quite long, so yeah, I mean, at least to have a dinner at a normal time. It's always hard, always is, every situation or every Vuelta is a different one. Still, I mean, yeah, okay, today we won, but tomorrow the big one to come, the queen stage, the hard climb at the end, and yeah, not finished yet, so on Sunday, yeah, is the final one to really put a line over the world up.
And win 1:45.55 over Ben O'Connor and more than 2 minutes over Enric Mas. Are you in a comfortable situation ahead
I mean, comfortable up or down, the climbs are the same. So, they are waiting for me, and I just have to suffer through and do my best. But again, like today, the most important is, yes, the team worked really well. The guys are good. Yes, I'm functioning good. So, first we have some fun, celebrate, and up for the next day. So.
Those were a long 5.5 kilometers. Did you ever think to yourself, oh, geez, this is a bit early?
Yeah, I mean, but you wait a bit and then it's one less and one less. But, it takes a while, yeah, definitely.
It's nearly 2 weeks for Ben O'Connor in that red jersey. What do you have to say about your rival over the last 2 weeks and how he fought to try to hold on to it?
Chapeau, huh? I mean, definitely amazing. Huh? I mean, he will also, yeah. Put him a lot as a rider. No matter how with the output, outcome. But still, I mean, he's up there. He will be up there still for tomorrow and the day after. Really a big chapeau. We have a nice fight with all the guys.
Finally, what's your thoughts going into tomorrow?
Well, I don't know. Let me celebrate today and leave it for tomorrow. Thanks.
Congrats.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode of our Vuelta coverage is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, I'm sure you're very familiar with the concept of a VPN by now, a virtual private network, primarily to keep your internet connection safe and secure wherever you are. Now, when I'm at home, we have our internet router connected to the NordVPN, and that means that every connection on our Wi-Fi is protected. But when I'm out and about, I've got NordVPN on my laptop and phone. And it just means that when I'm accessing the internet, wherever I am, I know that my connections are safe and secure and that my data is being encrypted. And it has all sorts of useful purposes, not least if you're away for work or on holiday and you want to watch your favourite sporting event or stream your favourite series, you can do so without falling foul of any geo restrictions. So NordVPN is the way to keep all of your data safe and secure and browse the internet wherever you are, but as if you are at home. It's quick, it's safe, it's secure. And as a Cycling Podcast listener, you can get a great discount if you go to nordvpn.com/TCP. That's nordvpn.com/TCP. There are some great discounts available. For example, if you sign up for a 2-year plan, you'll get 4 months extra for free. There's also a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you have a look at how it works and decide it's not for you, you can get a full refund. Can't say fairer than that. Go to nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, Rob, I've never felt closer in spirit to Primož Roglič. He decided that they would go for the stage win today because he thought, well, things were moving too slowly in the peloton and he was scared of missing dinner. A rider, a man after my own heart.
You can tell it's stage 19, can't you?
Yes, it was. But what did you make of that? Roglič, not giving very much away, never does. Not giving very much away at all about the extent to which it was a plan concocted this morning, or a plan concocted in the team car, maybe shortly before they came to the Alto de Moncavillo, or at the point where they realised the brake wasn't as strong as it has been on other days. And the configuration of the stage that we've been talking about, we've been interviewing riders for days now, George Bennett, Jack Haig, and so on, the configuration that Primož Roglič prefers was materializing. It was a day with a brake that wasn't the strongest, the pace wasn't the fastest. I mean, I was looking at my watch and the stage was already kind of behind schedule with 30 kilometers to go, and I think it ended up even further behind schedule, and it was going to be one big power dump on the final climb, and that's what it turned into.
Yeah, you could see actually it was a fast enough start. First hour at just under 50 kilometres per hour. But then once that 5 minute gap came, that decision you talked about back in the car was obviously made by Patchy Villa, Shane Archibald, and the sports directors who were there. And you could see very quickly that the organisation came. And well, I think the first check would have been, well, let's get it down, keep it under check. And once they had it, quite quickly, to be honest, in the space of 20, 30 kilometres, maybe that third category climb in the middle, helping the peloton behind with all the power in against the very tired looking five riders. You know, even Del Toro, he was getting dropped before they started the final climb today. It was down to below 2 minutes. So it was always going to be the peloton were coming back. Mm. And, you know, they didn't have to wait until even 100 metres past the Comienza Puerto sign, the start of the climb. They got them back. It was on. They had to fight for position anyway. So everything sort of just, the dominoes fell, didn't they? All in order for Primoz Roglic to do what Primoz Roglic does. He got his gap early. You wondered. A few other people wondered. I think I'll put my hand up. I was one of them wondering if it was a little bit too early because we saw Mass coming back at one point. But no, it was perfectly executed and a bit of a foregone conclusion, really, wasn't it? I think quite a few kilometres from the finish.
Another subject that Primoz Roglic didn't shed too much light on, and the one slight doubt, well, one of the other slight doubts I have about that attack was whether Florian Lipovic was part of the plan. Because he was sort of cut adrift. Mm. And at times in this Vuelta, it has seemed as though Bora Hansgrohe, or Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, have been hedging their bets to a certain extent. Not that the white jersey and its importance, its prestige, can in any way be compared to the red jersey and its prestige. But it has seemed as though, at times, they have wanted to have their cake and eat it, in the sense that they've wanted to go for both things. But he was cut adrift, and he did recover and didn't lose any significant ground, although it's looking more difficult for him on the white jersey front than it was this morning, certainly.
It is. He will probably need to have a very good day tomorrow and a very good time trial to make sure he's in the white jersey. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. What is he, just over a minute back now? But I think Primoz Roglic as well also said in his post-race declarations, as diplomatically as possible.
Declarations. You can make declarations when you're leading the race. You can't really make declarations when you've just lost 2 minutes, can you? Like a presidential address.
Too much time thinking in Spanish. Sorry, mate. He was saying that, you know, we're here. We are here for one goal, aren't we? And being as polite as possible in saying that, I think, you know, he probably won't get Lipovic listening to that, thankfully. So there you go.
Very expansive Rog. He hasn't been too expansive over the last few days. It's been a lot of, you know what I mean, huh? It will be harder.
We will have to see, huh?
Yeah. Rob. Primoz Roglic is not joining us tonight, but who knows, we might get him on the podcast one of the next couple of days. You did speak to one Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe rider who did give a little bit more information about the genesis of that stage winning attack today. It was Alexander Vlasov. Here's what he said.
Alex, congratulations, super plan. It looks spectacular on the TV. Was that the plan all day long?
Yeah, this was the plan. Actually, we didn't plan to go for a stage, you know, because we didn't know which brick we would be. But yeah, and then we decided that, yeah, it's pretty easy to control. Not a lot of guys in the break. Yeah, and in the final climb, yeah, it was already planned before, yeah, that we do.
So, Rog in great shape now, looking extremely good, well set, well poised to win his fourth Vuelta a España, although we must caveat it and say that we've been hearing for a week now, week plus, that tomorrow's stage, well, it's the stuff that nightmares, Roglician nightmares, could be made of. However, let's talk, shall we, about Ben O'Connor's, well, his 12 days in the red jersey, but ending with his, it wasn't a capitulation by any stretch of the imagination, by his very noble defence and concession of that red jersey today.
I thought he's fought brilliantly, and standing around at the finish line, you went off to interview him. I was hanging around talking to Vlasov and a couple of other people, and when he came across the line, he had a brilliant applause. The Spanish fans have really taken to him in the last few weeks, and that can be explained, I think, when you and I were stood in the mix zone, maybe distracted by the dinosaur this morning, trying to speak to a few riders. All I could hear in the background was, O'Connor, 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 and a load of Spanish kids shouting his name. They were brilliant, and he was being as polite as possible, trying to make time for everyone as he came down the stage after having signed in the morning. But he's become a bit of a star here this week, and he's done that. It was that day, where was he riding to? Junquera, 119 kilometres in the breakaway on stage 6.
taking the red jersey, and he's not ceded it since. And you know, when that happened, certainly when you saw what happened in Cazorla at that point, and everyone was saying, oh, Granada's coming up because he loses it already tomorrow. No, he's been there, and they were saying all over the second week, weren't they? Ay, Galicia, day after day after day, there's mountain after mountain. But no, he has dug in, he has fought, and he's put in a real leader's performance, and I think, I hope, won a heck of a lot of fans.
Can he keep second place tomorrow? I was listening in on an interview that Enric Mas gave to some of our colleagues earlier on, and we'll talk about Mas's position in a bit more depth in just a second. But Mas, well, he still says that the goal is to win the Vuelta a España. He has to get round over across Ben O'Connor first to get to that second place.
That isn't going to be easy at all, even if he does have a very good day tomorrow, because Enric Mas, Ben O'Connor in the time trial, I think I'm backing the Australian, to be honest. Certainly the way he's been going and developing, certainly the way the team's developing as well. Obviously, legs are tied, age 21, you really don't know what's going to happen in a time trial like that. But I think that Enric Mas would need a very decent cushion going into Sunday on Ben O'Connor to keep the second place, and we'll see.
You think that Ben O'Connor was slightly self-critical, as I said earlier, very frustrated with his own performance? We talked earlier today about, these are the conversations we have in the car sometimes, what we think we would each be like in the mix zone as an interviewee. I think I would be a very self-critical, self-flagellating rider, so I can identify with Ben O'Connor. I can also identify with Ben O'Connor in the same way I can identify with Primoz Roglic, saying that he wanted a quick stage today so he could get dinner. Ben O'Connor talking about how he couldn't wait for this Vuelta to end so that he could enjoy a few beers. We have that license every night.
We don't have that problem, do we? No. By the way, if you ever come the Rioja, madre mia, how cheap is the wine here? How good and how cheap. But Ben O'Connor might want to come back on his holidays up here. Maybe not to Rioja, because this is where he lost the jersey, but somewhere a little nicer. Maybe back down to Andalusia, where he won it.
But he deserves to hold on to certainly a podium place, doesn't he? But I don't think, I mean, we spoke to several riders after the finish, and I mentioned earlier that Skelmoser, well, you could almost feel the sort of ominous silhouette of Sugarman looming over him in the mix zone. And I think a lot of riders are simply very worried about tomorrow's stage. They're all very tired, and it's a case of sort of crossing everything, including Primoz Roglic. I think Primoz Roglic is not going to be relaxed by any stretch of the imagination tonight, although he does have a good gap. You know, you talked earlier about UAE and the possibility that they might try to turn the race upside down from the first climb, and someone could well get caught up in the collateral damage, and it could be Primoz Roglic, who knows?
And obviously there's previous there. I don't want to upset Roglic fans by doing that, but I mean, we wouldn't be doing our job as journalists without, unfortunately,
reminding people about his propensity for a penultimate stage wobble later on.
We are, and again, I'm not going to buy into it completely, because I know there's danger of over-dramatising that, and you know, most riders have probably had a problem at that point in their careers, haven't they? But yes, there is previous there. To me, the way I'm looking at it, if you're asking if I think it's going to happen, no, I think he's looking great. I think he's looking absolutely brilliant. But there is that chance tomorrow for chaos to be caused, not necessarily by the teams in the top five. Certainly UAE, they've got nothing to lose and everything to gain, haven't they?
Quick word on Salt Bae.
Salt Bae's impressed me. Salt Bae.
Let's hear what he said, shall we? Let's hear a little bit of what he said, and we will summarize.
David, on parlait l'autre jour de la possibilité de faire le podium. Là, maintenant, c'est jouable.
Je savais pas dire que c'est jouable parce que il reste une étape. Certes, pas peut-être la brand de cette Volta.
So, Rob, I put it to Salt Bae, who had a mouthful of not very expensive gold leaf steak, but Haribo. I put it to him that maybe the podium finish that I sort of teased him with a couple of days ago, it was yesterday, wasn't it? It might indeed be a possibility. I mean, he's got a lot of ground to make up, hasn't he? Let's just remind the listeners of where he is on general classification. Second today on the stage. Remember, Salt Bae fourth, David Gaudu fifth on general classification. He is 4:33 down on Roglic, which makes him, Rob, how far adrift of the podium? Currently 2:13. It's a tall order. I think if I look at the contenders, I suppose, for the podium, I suppose you'd have to throw Skelmoser in there as well, although I think he's mainly focused on the white jersey. You could tell that in his interview in the mix zone that he was mainly talking about Sugarman, wasn't he? But if I look at O'Connor, Mas, Carapaz,
and Gourdou, the one I feel is most likely to take risks, because we've heard throughout this Vuelta that he and his team are minded to take risks. They have come here, again, like Mas, with the hope of winning this Vuelta a España. It's Carapaz.
Definitely, certainly not risk-averse. Unfortunately, Mas, I think, is. And I was saying to you off mic, well, he's been on the podium of the Vuelta a España before. I would love him to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of what he
would
could do
tomorrow.
I would
love it if he beat
them. I would love it if he not. But I won't go that far. But I think that, listen, there's two sides to this, as there's the most stories. If I'm putting my professional head on, I'm going to say I can completely understand why they'd like to go for second place, and they think it's unrealistic because a lot of UCI points, a lot of, this is the Vuelta a España, of course, Movistar Spanish team finishing second rather than, you know, potentially losing it and plummeting down the standings. When everyone's watching at the weekend, television, newspapers, it's not a good look for a Spanish team. So I can completely understand why they would be reticent to throw everything down and throw the chips and bet on one particular number coming home. As a cycling fan, I'm thinking, come on, come on, go for it, go for it. What a stage we could have. But again, I think, I think anybody close enough to know how the sport works, how important the points are, budgets are, sponsorships, you can completely understand why he would be looking at the realistic prospect now of protecting another podium place.
Rob, we're also at the stage of the phase of this particular Grand Tour when, as someone who works in the mix zone in the morning, and you experience that you've seen it over the last 3 or 4 days, on one hand you get on social media people pleading, begging for someone like Carapaz to risk it all, and then we are treated every morning sort of a defile of zombies in the mix zone, everyone sort of one, yeah, pale, anemic, tired, complaining, not able to wait for this Vuelta a España to end. And I think that that is the reality for a lot of, that's certainly the reality inhabiting a lot of these guys' bodies and legs in particular. So you always have to caveat what you might hope is going to happen tomorrow with the knowledge that they're really on their reserve battery at the moment, a lot of guys.
And you and I have been lucky to have a little bit of extra time to hang around the buses in the last 2 or 3 days as well. It's been lovely being back around that for me as well, and just chatting to people off the record, riders, DSs, obviously all going to remain nameless, but there's just nothing left. You know, you might have the pressure above to go out there and win a stage, to go out on the attack, but you can try all you want. If the legs aren't there, you're not going to take anything, are you?
Well, Rob, we've changed locations. Explain to the listeners, describe to the listeners where we are now. Quite a beautiful scene.
It's like a midsummer scene, isn't it? Late afternoon, evening. The sky is almost completely clear. Beautiful blue and a setting sun over the far side. We've got long shadows from long trees. We're in a meadow. We can see trampled flowers where this sort of makeshift car park outside the press room has done the damage. But it's a beautiful, beautiful area. Just at the base of the climb, I would say we're about 300 metres from where the start of the climb official was, where Primož Roglič did what he did.
Any wildlife, Rob?
We've just seen a cricket jump onto the bonnet, haven't we?
You were quite excited about this. Cricket, yes. Was it a cricket? Are you sure it was a cricket? I always get mixed up in crickets, cicadas, all that kind of stuff. They all kind of blur into one for me. Locusts.
Thankfully, it wasn't a locust. There would have been a swarm of them, wouldn't there?
Wildlife, Rob. It falls upon us to update the listeners on the progress of the Lynx of Marbella, who is inching ever closer to Madrid. Of course, Luis Angel Mate, he told us a few days ago he wasn't terribly optimistic about making it to Sunday. Of course, we had his press conference in the press room yesterday, in which he formally announced that he will end his professional career on Sunday in Madrid, and I am pleased to tell you that the Lynx of Marbella, Luis Angel Mate of Euskaltel Euskadi, finished the day safely, as he has most days, safely in the middle of the pack, 78th, 14 minutes 59 seconds down. You see there, Robbie won the sprint for 78th place in a group of about 10 riders. Rob, we featured the Lynx generously, handsomely, copiously on this year's Vuelta podcast. And today, this morning, in fact, I believe, we released a Kilometer Zero, a friend special for friends of the cycling podcast. A Lynx special, indeed, because on the rest day, that was on Monday in Asturias, I went to meet him at his hotel, Hotel Piedra, it was called. We had a long, wide-ranging conversation about his career until now and what awaits him on the other side. Rob, we're going to have a little appetizer for it. Hopefully, our dinner isn't too far away. We're going to have an appetizer of that episode right now. The Lynx's Last Dance.
I wanted to ask you about another one of your great friends, another Italian, Michele Scarponi. I remember a comment from you after Michele died. I think it was after he died that really struck me. You described his relationship with his region, and you called him the William Wallace of the Marche.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I was in his home because I passed a lot of time with him in Filotrano, in his town, in his home. And he's always joking, and he said, "Listen, Luis, listen. Everybody loves me here. I am like William Wallace here. I show Michele in Florencia. I show Michele in the same time." Yeah, you know, Michele was a really, really special person. Not only Michele, all his family. I have in contact also with his mother, his father, his brother Marco, Silvia, his sister. He's a really special family. And Michele was someone unique person. And for me, it was also a really, really important in my life because he learned me to be happy, to live the life. That is the most important thing. I always with Michele in my heart because was the number one.
So Rob, that was a very short extract of what I hope, what I like to think was a poignant and very engaging conversation. It was mainly him talking, not much of me. A near monologue from the Lynx of Marbella, as I said, special release today, The Lynx's Last Dance. Those of you who don't already have access to our friend specials, Kilometer Zeros, can do so, can become a friend of the podcast on thecyclingpodcast.supportingcast, that's all one word, .fm. And on there, you will find all the information about how to sign up and the benefits that come with being a friend of the Cycling Podcast. Rob, you've been data mining on the links.
Well, I've had it put on a plate for me from a very well-known cycling website. 60,000 kilometres ridden by the Lynx in 373 stages in 18 Grand Tours, which is equal in just Grand Tours in his career. Let me remind everyone, he's done a heck of a lot more races than that, to 1.5 times around the world. So if that's not worth signing up for Friends of the Cycling Podcast, what isn't? I can say I listened to it this morning on the way. It's a lovely listen, a brilliant listen. If I haven't already signed up, Daniel, I'd be rushing to do so now.
There you go. Bit of an empty gesture since you already have signed up. But thank you, Rob. Thank you very much. Rob, talking about data mining, there are various teams on this Vuelta a España and in pro cycling in general, in the upper echelons of pro cycling, who are famous for their use of data science, sports science, and I suppose over the last few years, the team known as Visma Lisabike have been one of them, have they not, Rob? However, they have found themselves in a bit of an invidious position over the last few months, the last 2 or 3 months, well, primarily because they've had so much bad luck, also because one of the key architects of their success over the last few years, Marijn Zeeman, has announced, and indeed he was the very first subject of our Encuentro del Día feature in this Vuelta a España. I'm talking about Marijn Zeeman. Which football team is he going to? Alkmaar, isn't it?
I said Alkmaar, yeah.
So, they have had to fill a Marijn Zeeman-shaped hole. And they're doing it with not one individual, but several. About five different specialists in different roles who are going to head up their sort of performance team next year, and one of the more intriguing names, Rob, is Jaco Verheeren, who is best known for his work in swimming. Very successful he has been too.
Yeah, and very recently at the Paris Olympic Games, Verheeren, 55.
Verheeren, sorry.
Verheeren, we'll get there. Verhaeren, 55-year-old Dutchman, Paris Olympic success for France. He was in charge of that. Daniel, they took 7 medals, 4 of them gold. They were 3rd in the medal table for swimming behind the US and Australia. And of course, he was in charge of the poster boy, wasn't he, for the Paris Olympic Games? I think it was Monsieur Marchand, was it Marchand?
Léon Marchand.
There you go.
Correct. Well, Rob, you were there this morning in, where were we this morning? Logroño, when we got the opportunity to meet and to a certain extent pick the brains of Mr. Verhaeren. Jacko, he is the subject of today's Encuentro del Día. It's a long one and I think you'll agree, a very interesting one.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, Jacko, I've been looking at a couple of interviews you've been doing with colleagues of mine already about your knowledge of cycling, and you say, I know nothing about cycling, or I did know nothing, because you've been here a few days and you've surely picked a bit up over the last few days. But when you come into an environment like this, what are the strangest things that strike you about this sport compared to the world that you've come from, swimming?
Well, obviously, it's a very different world. Well, yes and no, actually. Like, you know, athletes are athletes, coaches are coaches. Like, the world of high performance is known to me. The world of cycling, very specifically, a lot less, of course. But what I see here is, it's impressive, you know, the logistics only already. Like, all the equipment, the bikes, the buses, the trucks, it's a total operation, really. And that is very different than swimming, you know. You move to, I'm just coming from the Olympics in Paris, you know, you move to one location, you stay there, and obviously you have a bus to go up and down to the pool, but that's about it. And here it's, you know, the challenges are not just, you know, the stages, obviously that's where the focus is. But it's more so the whole operation around it. So and that is what I really wanted to see in my first week, to get that experience too.
Tell me about how this came about. Who pitched to who? Was it you responding to, I don't know, whether Richard advertised for this position, or did you approach him? How did it come about?
No, there wasn't an advertisement. It was like, actually, the real story is I was before already a bit in contact with Marijn, and he. So we exchanged ideas always. Marijn was always very interested in other sports as well, as am I. So we exchanged ideas about how do you do this with the team, what does training there look like, what does coaching look like, and everything. And then he asked one day to do a presentation for the team, for the coaches, the performance coaches. And so I did that, and I really enjoyed, you know, just meeting the coaches, sharing my story from my world of swimming and what we do in high performance there. And a few days later, he gave me a call. He said, are you interested in taking a job with us? I said, well, I'm surely interested, but I have another job. That was before the Olympics in Paris. But from that moment on, I really started following much more intensely the world of cycling. So I got involved with their performance team. So I know a lot more already than from the start. And actually, last Sunday, I started officially, let's say, with the team in my new role.
What in the presentation do you think impressed them? Maybe I should ask Marijn.
I don't think it was actually the presentation. It was more our contact. You should ask him for sure. But it was more our contact over the years, knowing from each other what we do. I've been leading swimming teams for the last 10 years, 7 years in Australia, 3 years in France. Before that, I was a coach myself in swimming. So that's where our worlds met. So I don't think it was just the presentation, but just knowing each other from the past already.
And for those who don't know and who haven't done the necessary research, Jacko, just tell us about go back a bit further. Are you a physiologist? Were you a swimmer yourself? Tell us a little bit about your journey to the elite in swimming.
Yeah, well, I did swim. We're talking now about the 80s. I did swim, but not on an international level. I was a decent swimmer, but I never made it to a European or world or Olympic Games. But I really enjoyed it. I loved the world of training. So when I was very young already, I became interested in training and pretty much peak performance, because that's what we do in swimming. You know, it's only one moment that really matters and you have to be there. So I wanted to make my job out of that. So I went through to sports school, CIOS it's called in the Netherlands. Did that for 3 years. Then I got into coaching. I started with a small team in Maastricht, which was more like a... well, nationally it was an okay team, but not internationally. I moved up to Eindhoven, that's where I still live now, in 92. That's where I met the first real international swimmers. 96 in Atlanta was my first Olympics, and I've been to every Olympics every 4 years.
Very successful for the Dutch swimmers, I think, 96? Is that a bit early?
96 was okay. We had a girl who had two bronze medals in 4 and 800 freestyle. 2000 was really good. Like we had five gold medals with Peter van den Hogenband. I don't know if your cyclist fans know this, but with Inge de Bruin, world records. And that was really the kickoff of a beautiful era for Dutch swimming, with a lot of medals, a lot of records. And then in 2012, after the London Olympics, I decided to quit as a coach. Was very successful as well, the London Olympics. I coached Ranomi Kromowidjojo. She was Olympic champion in the 50 and 100 freestyle. So for me, the circle was round. And I thought, now it's time to go and do something else. I didn't know what it exactly was. But shortly after, I got a phone call from Australia, Swimming Australia, to become the performance director there, or team director. And that's where I took a totally different role, still in swimming, but a totally different role in leading the teams, working with the coaches, with the staff, with the athletes, but a little bit more from a distance, structuring that. I spent 7 years there, and then after I started preparing the French team in the same role as a team director for the Paris Olympics. And that's so that just finished. Was a very successful Olympic Games, fortunately for the French. Léon Marchand was extremely successful, but the whole team actually was very good there, so I was very happy with that. Then I took 2 weeks a break, and then now we're here.
I was going to ask you, just before we wrap up, Léon Marchand, obviously, we all become swimming experts for 2 weeks, having not followed the sport. I guess there have maybe been people here who have asked you, what's he like, and what's his secret? What's the sort of one-minute version of why he was so successful in the Paris Olympics?
Well, obviously, he has talent, but pretty much everyone I see here has talent too. So that's not the secret. The secret is always, I don't think it is a secret, but... it's working hard, working consistently. He was really physically, but also mentally prepared for that, you know, to do a home games. Like it takes, it gives a lot more pressure and expectation. And he was able in within that to really stay himself. So we worked a lot with him on his mental capabilities, as well as his physiology and everything. And I didn't feel for a moment that he was too impressed by the whole environment. You know, it takes a few years to get to that point where you can really give the best of yourself, even when the expectations are very high. And I think, you know, that is very similar in this world as well. You know, if you can work consistently, if you have your goals, you can work as a team. Because in swimming, believe it or not, we work as a team as well. It's a very individual sport, but everything before and after the race is team. It's just like this. And here it's even during the race, it's team-based. And those are the things I think we can learn from each other in these different worlds.
Last thing, I just said to your press officer that this team needs some new superstitions, because you've had so much bad luck this year. What do you like on superstitions? This is a very superstitious sport, particularly the Italians. If you ever knock over salt on the table, then it's a big crisis. Are you an expert on superstitions? Can you bring some new ones for this team?
No, I'm really not in that. I'm not into superstitions. I'm really into sticking to your process. You know, like your performance process. What do you do before the race? During the race? How do you work together as a team? I really believe the team dynamic, the team culture, is incredibly important in any sport. You know, over the years, the teams I've worked with and where it went wrong, it always goes wrong on the cultural side. It's not the technical side. We know everything about training. We have great experts, everything. So there's no need to be superstitious. I think you just need to be focused on every day on what you can control.
Well, Rob, impressive fella, I thought. And if one was to be worried, if one was a die-hard Visma Lisa Bike fan, and one was worried about the direction of that team might take with Marijn Zeeman's departure, I think some of those fears, some of those worries might have been sort of assuaged by that conversation today.
It's like the new manager coming in and giving a real good press conference, wasn't it? I'm going to sign this player, I'm going to sign that player, we're going to play attractive football, we're going to win. No, he's a great talker, wasn't he? And, you know, he was very confident in all of his previous achievement, but humbling the same way, talking about the hard work that everybody has to do, the buy-in, the culture, all of that sort of, the magic buzzwords of performance directors and people like that. But it isn't just about the magic words, is it? It's about putting in the hard yards, as you mentioned, the performance. And I think he certainly on first look, first guess, he's going to be great for us, for the media. He's going to be a fantastic outlet for the team. And if he does his job behind the scenes, then well, be worried UAE and the rest.
Can worries be assuaged? Maybe, possibly. A lot of riders are worried about tomorrow's stage. Let's talk about it now, shall we?
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Rob, quickly, last evening's dinner was an interesting one, an eventful one, quite an amusing one. The circumstances which sort of preceded it.
Yes, we turned up at the famous Calle Laurel, didn't we? Which is a big tapas sort of street, buzz street, bars, people standing everywhere. A little bit touristy, I guess, in Logroño, but, you know, it's the sort of identity of the town. Little glasses of wine on sale, food here and there. We walked up, walked down it. We didn't really find anywhere we wanted to go in. I didn't want
tippy tapas.
You
was
didn't
why.
Want tippy tapas.
It was an I expressed my disapproval of this generally. I don't like how non-committal tippy tapas is. And obviously I've had lots of dinners over the years with Spanish friends, and it just causes me great frustration that there is that moment of commitment in the evening never arrives. Shall we get some of this? Shall we get some of this?
No,
it's not nice. This is turning into a very famous sort of reprisal of a very famous scene from the English sitcom Gavin and Stacey, when they're talking about sharing Indian takeaways. I feel a bit like that about tippy tapas.
Dearie me, you would not get on with a lot of people, certainly on the mainland in Spain. Moving on, we did decide to go and have a drink somewhere, didn't we? Lovely little place on the corner. Had a restaurant upstairs, and then we met my colleagues from Eurosport, our colleagues in general, and they were sort of changing their own mind. They didn't want a sit-down meal, and they were going for what you named as tippy tappy tapas. I'm a bit offended by that as a sort of an adopted Spaniard, but we'll let that one just slide. They didn't want that, did they? So we went upstairs, gladly took their table. Didn't lie when I said I was from Eurosport, did I? We took that on, but there was already quite a disappointed waiter because we said I was four of us instead of five of us. Okay, no problem. We sat down and, Where's Alberto? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Contador's not coming. And they were expecting Alberto Contador, and they were waiting, Daniel, with a wine, weren't they?
Yeah, Contador on the label. Contador.
How much was it, though?
It wasn't that expensive, but Contador, I don't think it was that expensive.
It was about 300 euros, wasn't it?
Are you
yeah,
sure?
It was 300 odd euros.
Oh, okay. Well, Contador is, it's a famous...
So, by the way, let's stop. We politely inform the waiter we would not be consuming that.
It is a famous... Rob, what are you doing in the car? Rob's got... Oh, he's gone to get his laptop. Contador is it's a Rioja and a very highly prized... Rioja. We had some good Rioja anyway, Rob. You mentioned earlier that it's very reasonable, extremely reasonable. Glasses of Rioja generally were going for sort of €3, €2,
less 50, than that, yeah.
250, €3 for, yes, very well known and very respected properties. Rob, is that all there is to say about yesterday's dinner? I believe it is. I'm going to move on to what we've got in store tomorrow. Yesterday, of course, I failed abjectly in finding a rider who could talk to us about Moncalvillo. I mistakenly identified Jack Hager, someone who had ridden this climb in 2020. I got that wrong. This morning, I went in search of someone who's familiar with the Picon Blanco, and I found someone who did excel, didn't win, and the stage didn't finish on top of Picon Blanco, but he excelled in a stage race in 2022. That stage race was the Vuelta a Burgos. He went on to win that stage race, and his name is Pavel Sivakov, and he presents tomorrow's stage for us.
And I talked to you yesterday about good memories of Picon Blanco. Obviously, yeah. It's tomorrow's stage.
Yeah.
Could you just sort of present this route for us and tell us what the difficulties are and how hard it's going to be tomorrow?
The Picon Blanco, this is the side we've done when I won the Volta Burgos where I attacked. But I'm pretty sure, so from the start, we passed the same road we rode down that day. So we're going up. And then the middle bit, I don't know it too well. But I think it's just going to be a repetition of climbs, I think, from that first downhill until... Basically, the last climb is just going to be a race full on, no flat at all. So, if you have the right jersey, this is an extremely hard day to control. Especially with how close all the GC is, I think it's just going to be fireworks from start to finish, everything to play, and actually until the last CT. So, I think this is going to be the queen stage of this Vuelta.
So, Rob, humdinger.
Has Siv got to the moon yet, by the way?
No, he's not. He's riding very well, though. I think he lost a place on general classification today.
He did. He moved down one place today. He was one of the first of the bigger name riders to disappear. But we'll see what he can pull off tomorrow. Tomorrow, though, it's a beast, isn't it? It starts in Biarcayo, heads to Picon Blanco, stage ridden among the vines of another famous wine, Ribera del Duero, in Burgos. There are, Daniel, 4,727 metres to climb over how many classified climbs? Let's count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Do it again. Seven classified climbs ending in Picon Blanco first category ascent. Of those first category ascents, there are three. There's a couple of second cats, there's two third cats, and the climbing really starts out the gun with unclassified climbing. It's going to be a mighty fight for the breakaway over the 172 kilometres and the final road stage already of this Vuelta a España.
And the general classification is still pretty delicately poised, Rob. Certainly the battle for the podium, but who knows? We've already discussed it. The possibility that hell will be let loose tomorrow and that Primoz Roglic could even be imperiled. We suspect he doesn't like the look of tomorrow's profile. Now, what would a Roglic capitulation undoing look like? Not content with wasting Jack Haig's time yesterday. Today, what happened in the mix zone? Well, I forgot Jack's birthday. He was 31 today, Bahrain victorious' Jack Haig. Certainly one of our most loyal and reliable and friendly, amenable conversation partners pretty much every day in the mix zone, whether it's at this race or every other race, in fact, in which he takes part. However, I wasted his time yesterday. I committed that cardinal journalistic sin today of asking him about riders, well, other than himself. And I asked him what a Primoz Roglic, or what would be the recipe for a Primoz Roglic undoing tomorrow on the stage to Picon Blanco.
Oh, no. Jack, if you've got the energy for it, I'm going to put you in the kitchen and tell you to cook up a recipe for Primoz Roglic's undoing over the last two stages. How would you go about it if you were one of those guys who were in third, fourth, fifth?
Well, to be honest, it might not need to be quite a difficult dish because he does a pretty good job of cooking it up himself in the last couple of stages. So I think for him, he can be his own worst enemy in this kind of situation. I've seen him in Paris-Nice crash on the last stage and lose the yellow jersey, I think, in 2021. I think there's been numerous other occasions where on the last day or the second last day, he's had a problem. Tour de France, time trial, yellow jersey. Pogacar beats him on the last day when it looked like he had it wrapped up. So the dish play doesn't need to be too difficult, and Primoz needs to just try and stay out of trouble, I think, because if you look at it on paper at the moment, he's definitely the clear favorite. 5 seconds between him and Ben O'Connor. Normally you would say that this 5 seconds he could easily take just in the time trial without needing today and tomorrow's stage. But just for my own satisfaction, I'd just make tiramisu because I really like it.
God. Okay. All right. Wow, Rob. Wow. Haig slams choker Rog.
I'm going to have a nice Sunday morning headline instead. Haig makes tiramisu.
Yes, yes. Maybe we've talked a lot in the past about tiramisu. Maybe we could draft Jack in as an impartial, well, taste.
Tolmezzo?
Tolmezzo is the place that contests the honour of having invented it with Treviso. Yes, maybe we will have to rope Jack in for our next adventures in the history of tiramisu. Don't know if we've got any tiramisu waiting for us in Burgos tonight, Rob. It is 8:10. We should probably be on our way. And, well, we're very excited about what's coming tomorrow, aren't we?
We certainly are. It's going to be a fantastic fight from the breakaway. Of course, I'm assured that it's on telly from start to finish tomorrow's is Sunday's race. So we'll all be able to watch every kilometre of it. And, of course, we'll be at the start house looking to see how everyone's feeling. I can guess already they're all knackered and they can't wait for it to end, can they?
Start house?
Sorry, I'm thinking it's a time trial already, aren't I?
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.